From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Laura Weber Davis, in for April Baer. Some officials say we need a federal coordinated effort to combat COVID-19.
The most important thing is you need some sort of emergency medical supply czar. You need one person who's accountable, who has experience managing what is arguably a very, very precedent-setting and complex operation.
We'll talk to Congresswoman Alyssa Slotkin, and we'll hear about one school teacher's experience in the Upper Peninsula during the Spanish flu.
Munising decided to close their schools immediately. So they then asked the teachers to serve as health clerks.
And our continued look at the role of billionaires in shaping society.
That kind of wealth concentration, just having people that wealthy in a society, is fundamentally incompatible with democracy.
Those conversations and more today on Stateside. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Laura Weber Davis, in for April Baer. Later in the show, we'll hear the story of a young woman who taught school in the Upper Peninsula during the Spanish flu and how her role in the community changed dramatically. But first, there have been numerous calls from officials for the federal government to create a more coordinated national response to the spread of COVID-19. That includes from Congresswoman Alyssa Slotkin, who represents Michigan's 8th Congressional District, and she joins us now. Representative Slotkin, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
So this morning on NPR, retired Army General Stanley McChrystal said that the fight against COVID-19 required a national response rather than state by state. So far, the president has deferred to state and local officials to take action. What do you think is the right response?
Yeah, well, you know, I wrote an op-ed yesterday that kind of outlined what I think needs to happen. And there's sort of five big things, but very quickly, I mean, the most important thing is you need some sort of emergency medical supply czar. You need one person who's accountable, who has experience managing what is arguably a very, very precedent-setting and complex operation. So I don't deny the difficulty of the mission, but I know that we have someone working at FEMA and someone working now with our retooling manufacturers. You've got the military doing their thing. You need a czar, a sort of senior person to oversee all that. Then, you know, FEMA is trying to catch up and is trying to play that role for procurement of supplies from, especially from overseas and China, especially. I think that's good that they're trying, and we've seen some results. But in the near term, it's just we know that they've been competing with our states, including Michigan. Mm-hmm. And so we want to just make sure that FEMA is doing that job without threatening existing orders. And then number three, the president needs to use the full powers of the Defense Production Act. He's talked about this. He's moved forward on it. But the truth is, folks like GM, Ventec making ventilators, Ford and GE making ventilators, they are retooling and moving out without any federal guaranteed orders. And what the president needs to do is ink some contracts, large contracts, to give those companies some predictability and stability, and then implement his powers under the DPA so that all the suppliers for those ventilators, all the 400 parts that go into a ventilator, they have top cover from the federal government to say, okay, I had existing orders, but I'm going to bump the federal government, the GM and Ventec orders to the top of my queue. Hmm. And then we need a worldwide logistics plan, right? A lot of the supplies that we're ordering right now are from China and other countries. They usually ship overseas, over the seas, and then are shipped by rail when they hit here. We just need to be picking them up by airplane, right? Our commercial aircraft are dying for things to be doing. Let them go and pick up those supplies and move them quickly to the points that really need them. So there's a bunch of other things that can be done, but those are the major ones that we could be doing now to help streamline the supply chain.
Do you think we're getting to be at a point where it's almost too late to do a national coordinated effort on this? The virus is just moving so quickly. And at this point, the states have really started to get control of what their plans are. At some point, isn't it just invaluable for the federal government to step in and say, hey, we're going to take over the operations now?
Well, listen, I think there's no doubt about it. We will have a lot of lessons learned after we're through this on what we could have done earlier. And certainly I've been vocal about this, that FEMA could have been doing this coordinated role basically since January, and building up the national stockpile, placing those large orders, and they're playing catch up now. It's important that they not try and now compete with the states. I do think that most states went out on the president's guidance, started making orders, purchasing equipment, and we are expecting at least some of that equipment to come in over the next 10 days to 2 weeks. That should not be touched by the federal government, but you know, this is going to go on for a while, and it's important that we get a better system than the one we have now, which is just the open market, competition, prices going up, and ultimately the taxpayer paying way more, for instance, per mask than they should have. I think the FEMA, I don't want them to disrupt us in the near term, but looking 3 or 4 weeks out, FEMA certainly could be doing a better job at centralizing supply.
Let's talk a little bit more about the stockpile. Should there have been a national stockpile that looked more like national oil reserves or something that would have anticipated a pandemic happening at some point?
Yeah, you know, the intelligence community has been talking about the increasing likelihood of a pandemic, a deadly pandemic, for over a decade. But the truth is, neither administration, Democrat or Republican, Congress controlled by Republicans or Democrats, have not fully invested the resources into the national stockpile. And I think we saw that very early on when the stockpile was opened up and states were asking for equipment, and we were getting 25% of what we asked for. And some states were getting, even less than that. So I think we've exposed real problems in our preparedness. And it's going to be part of our lessons learned process when this is over. That's what the military always does, is sort of an after action report when you get through a crisis. And there's already members of Congress, myself included, talking about how do we mandate a certain level of supplies in our national stockpile. Frankly, I've been talking with my peers about, you know, whether we've outsourced too much of our medical supply chain. I mean, the fact that we are fighting hard to get masks from China and don't have enough, you know, US-based supply, I think that's a strategic vulnerability. And we weren't thinking about it ahead of time, but the truth is we have very strict requirements for military equipment and how much of that could ever be outsourced, very small amount. I think we should have similar standards on the medical supply chain and prescription drugs.
When you talk about lessons learned and when everything is sort of taken into account and the multiple studies are done about what went wrong and what could have been done better, is it only applicable then to future pandemics, or can you relate that information to other potential global catastrophes like global warming?
That's interesting. I mean, I think we are going to have, COVID in our life for a while. And while we will make it through this first initial wave, I think most doctors and researchers will tell you that similar to the way flus are cyclical, then we're likely to see this again, potentially, you know, next fall. And I think we have a job to do to be prepared in the near term. I do think this pandemic is showing us what the face of homeland security is really starting to look like. It's not just preparing ourselves to deal with a potential terrorist attack or a major altercation with a world power. It's about protecting our families here on the ground. And right now that's a pandemic. But absolutely, I mean, I think environmental security needs to be treated like homeland security, because it's quite literally about the safety and security of our families and the preservation of our way of life. So I do think there'll be really waves of lessons that come out of this conflict or this crisis, similar to 9/11. I mean, it was a generational event. You know, before 9/11, we didn't take off our shoes when we went through TSA, and, you know, we were out able to carry our water bottles, and we were, you know, could go into any building we wanted without showing ID. You know, we changed as a society after 9/11. And I think that we're set to do the same thing after COVID-19. I mean, who among us won't be more aware of personal space and distancing, germs? I just think we're in the middle of something really generational, and we will not be the same after we come through it. We will absolutely come through it. And Lord knows Michigan has stood up in a way that the whole country is watching with our manufacturing retooling. But we will be different.
Some of your colleagues in the House have called for demographic tracking of the COVID cases, especially here in Detroit. We've seen that most of the cases being out of the city that is 80 to 85% black. We still don't have a centralized database of demographic information about who's getting sick and who's dying. Should there be a national database of demographics, and could that be easily coordinated?
Yeah, you know, I was just on a call, a bipartisan call with something called the Problem Solvers Caucus, which is equal numbers of Democrats and Republicans. And we had the former head of the FDA as our sort of special guest. And it is definitely clear that the folks who are being hospitalized and certainly those who are going to the ICU with COVID tend to have another comorbidity. You know, they have another issue like heart disease or diabetes that makes them more vulnerable. I think the CDC and the FDA should indeed be tracking this information. I think in a less of a crisis-ridden state, they would be producing this information. And obviously, we all need to know and understand the trends as close to real time as we can get it. I just think right now they are not putting that out. And we've been urging them to produce more information publicly. And I hope that they will, because I think we're all learning. We're in the beginning edge of this thing. We're just trying to understand who it affects. And right now, we need to deal with the immediate gaps, which are things like personal protective equipment for healthcare workers and tests. But we will need to understand the data as soon as possible. So we're just going to have to keep pushing them to put it out.
Well, would it require an act of Congress, or could it be done internally without that act?
No, it does not need an act of Congress. The federal agencies, you know, I was in the federal government for almost 15 years, and much of this stuff is about direction and leadership and decisions to be transparent by the senior most folks at these agencies and departments. And I don't want to get to the point where we have to legislate to get them to produce information that we all need. I think that they may be overwhelmed. And it's a matter of putting pressure on them rather than legislating, which would probably take longer anyways.
Congresswoman Alyssa Slotkin, thank you so much.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Alyssa Slotkin represents Michigan's 8th Congressional District. She joined us by Skype. Coming up, the role of the uber wealthy in philanthropy and social change.
You have a lot of fundamentally decent people upholding a profoundly indecent system.
Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Laura Weber Davis, in for April Baer. Yesterday on the show, we had a long conversation on the outsized influence of billionaires in Michigan, focusing on Metro Detroit billionaires. Today, we explore another angle. In his book, Winners Take All, journalist Anand Giridharadas covers the massive influence of billionaires in philanthropic work and in shaping society. He's a University of Michigan grad and was in Ann Arbor last fall to speak at the school. While he was here, he called on U of M to remove billionaire Stephen M. Ross's name from the Ross School of Business. Giridharadas says Ross's support of President Trump is antithetical to U of M's mission of higher learning and inclusivity. But Ross is also a major donor to Michigan, giving nearly $400 million to the university over time. Anand Giridharadas joined me in studio while he was in Ann Arbor, and here's our conversation. Anand, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
Well, let's talk about that gift. I mean, if you're in the university's position, it's hard to turn away hundreds of millions of dollars being sent your direction, isn't it? Especially in face of state cuts that have forced tuition hikes. Well, this is at least from the perspective of the university. They've seen their funding cut in a certain way that forces them to consider large donations from those who might want to support the university based on their own philanthropic dollars.
It's a great question, and it allows us to get to the kind of macro picture of how this works. You're right that we live in a country and here in Michigan, a state where cuts to education and various other forms of public things create the situation in which institutions do feel desperate and are desperate. That said, I don't think all money is admissible just because Universities have to be very careful not to be drive-through reputation laundromats that provide a service of moral cleansing to people who don't deserve moral cleansing. You know, I think in the case of these cutbacks and therefore needing to turn to people like Ross, you got to understand that that's sort of the point of the donation, right? Like, people like Ross benefit enormously from the politics of austerity, from a politics where you tax them less, you don't tax their wealth, you tax their inheritances less, you let them go to the Cayman Islands, not for vacation, but for tax dodging. And then when the state has less money, therefore, when the federal government has less money, therefore, you are then desperate for the same people who might have saved $1 billion through the aforementioned practices to give you $100 million for a thing. And for them, it's a great bargain because they've saved $1 billion. Now they spend $100 million, but what do they get with the $100 million? They get the glow of a hero. If you just pay your taxes, if you just comply with the law and you pay that billion, no one actually writes articles about you. No one puts you in a magazine. No one pumps up your ego. You just merely complied with the law. Mm-hmm. If you evade and save $1 billion and give $100 million, you get so much hero worship. And you get a bunch of students who appreciate you, and you get a bunch of influential faculty members who have a platform and a voice and are smart, kind of living in fealty to you. And so you can save $900 million through this very clever method. And I think universities, I mean, having studied here, this university is committed to some very specific values. And I think it really needs to think about creating a set of standards for receiving money from people who are not actively committed in their lives to destroying everything this university stands for.
How often do we see that nationally where philanthropic dollars from billionaires, hundred millionaires, very wealthy people have been stepping in to craft cities or form municipalities in their image?
It's happening a lot. But I want to point out, even in the question, like some of the language is very interesting because it's part of, I think, how we've gotten in the situation. So you said, you know, a lot of cities or whatever are falling short in terms of their budgets, right? And that these billionaires are stepping in. So I would tell the story a slightly different way.
Please.
Which is that the reason they're falling short is because of a concerted campaign over the last 30 or 40 years by these very same billionaires and the larger class they belong to create the conditions in which they would fall short, right? They have pushed, as you know, for low taxes. They've pushed for things like the Trump tax cut. They've pushed for regulations that would leave workers with less stability, thus straining the state even more in various ways. And then, having pushed for that world, lo and behold, given their wealth and power, they got that world, a lot of it, right? They got their Trump tax cut. They got tax cuts in the state of Michigan. And then, yes, you're right, cities and state budgets start to fall short. But it's not passive voice like it happened. You know, like, it was made to happen. Someone did that. And then, with the second term, stepping in. I mean, if I break someone's leg, am I stepping in to give them a cast? You know, I think when you light a fire, it's very morally complicated if that arsonist reinvents themselves as a firefighter. Just because you say you're a firefighter and show up with a hose and some water doesn't mean you didn't start that fire and doesn't mean we've forgotten. And so in the state of Michigan, this phenomenon of philanthropy is maybe even more prominent than in many other states. There's a lot of wealth in this state. But when this wealth has stepped in, it's often stepping in to solve the problem it has helped cause.
Is there a role for billionaires in revitalizing cities? Is there a role for billionaires that is important in urban planning and crafting a modern American and successful city?
Yes, but what I always advocate for first is I actually think we don't need billionaires to spend as much time as they do thinking about how to do more good. We need them to spend more time thinking about how to do less harm. Right. So first of all, before you get to your little do-gooding projects and picking some, you know, minority neighborhood that you want to tell all your friends in the suburb that you helped save, before you do that, do an audit of your own complicity in these problems to begin with, right? What kind of taxes do you pay? Do you use weird trusts and, you know, real estate investment trusts and opportunity zones, which are not really intended to help you hide your money, and these kinds of philanthropic tax dodges? Do you use weird Caribbean islands to hide your money? Do you pay your workers enough? It's pretty obvious in the state of Michigan that a lot of the problems that have been occurring in the state of Michigan have to do with too much money going to too few hands and not being paid out as wages or taxes. So before you get to some pet project or building some playground, you know, for a few minority kids that you want to take a selfie with and, you know, and put on your website, think about the ways in which you are actively fueling through your business practices and taxation practices and your lobbying activities. Lobbying is another big part of this, right? When you lobby for something, you're not just lobbying for yourself. In fact, your motivation is for yourself. You don't want to have that regulation, or you don't want to have to pay that higher wage, or you don't want to have to, you want to benefit from that tax giveaway. The problem is when you lobby for something, you also end up creating that thing for everybody else in the state or the country. So a lot of people, to save $10 million, will push for an amendment that also costs, it saves a lot of other people $10 million, which essentially may end up costing a state like $1 billion. And then you turn around and you say, oh, what a shame. These kids in Detroit, no playgrounds, no pencils. What a terrible situation. And the government not solving this problem. Dude, you were at the government's door like last week begging for the government to not buy those kids pencils, in effect, and give you more money for, you know, your home in the UP.
What really strikes me, when you say weird islands or weird trust funds, they're weird to you or I, but to them, it's out of a community that is completely, I would assume, normal. Which leads me to think about who are the community of people that they are communicating with, circling with? Who are the cliques among the Bill Gateses of the world? Are they ever really in communion with people who are experiencing the types of needs that are along the lines of needing pencils, needing, you know, roads paved? Or is that just something that's totally out of the realm of their understanding?
It's a great question. I think it's a question that gets at the heart of the problem. I think a lot of what I found in reporting Winners Take All is that you have a lot of fundamentally decent people upholding a profoundly indecent system. And it's at one level hard to explain how decent people uphold an indecent system. And so I tried to kind of investigate how that works. And one of the ways that works is honestly a lack of information. A lot of people at the very, very top of our society, by virtue of being at the top, by virtue of flying privately and therefore not going to the airports you and I go to, by virtue of living in, you know, gated enclaves that you and I are cut off from, by virtue of vacationing in, you know, places that are far from everybody else, by virtue of essentially seceding from the society without leaving, are cut off from a pretty substantial amount of basic information about what other people's lives are like. I think this is a very important thing. You know, a lot of us as citizens voting, advocating for things, it kind of depends on, I mean, you doing the job you do. You kind of have to have some basic understanding of what's going on in a society, what other people are going through, whether most people are hurting or not. And you get that as a normal person by like walking around, talking to people, having friends, going to restaurants. You get a lot of data and you don't even think you're doing that.
But didn't these guys start as normal people?
Right, but that was a long time ago. First of all, a lot of them did not start as normal people. And that's their myth. A lot of them started as totally normal, you know, white guys inheriting fortunes. So
right.
That helps. But the reality is, you know, I had an interesting phone call with Jamie Dimon, runs JP Morgan Chase and runs the Business Roundtable, the umbrella organization of CEOs of the biggest companies in America. He didn't like a quote that I gave about one of his initiatives in the New York Times. So he emails me like, we got to talk. Never heard of this guy. I mean, never heard from this guy before, but I call him. We have a conversation. To his credit, he does not go off the record. We have a full half an hour conversation, argument. And at some point in this discussion, he basically, I said, look, you claim you want to do right by your workers and you can do it voluntarily. I think it's better we pass laws insisting the companies take care of their workers, insisting of a higher wage. And he says, you know, it's not necessary. I mean, I'm conscientious. I said, you know, you may be conscientious, but there are signatories. Let's set you aside for a second. There are signatories of this new statement your group is putting out calling for a humane capitalism. There are signatories, CEOs of that statement that I know and you know run companies that are incredibly exploitative. You know that. And he said, you know, I've met some of those CEOs and they're very nice guys. So I don't really believe that they exploit workers. And he says, besides, a lot of people in this country just, you know, don't like to work. Hmm. Now think about that. If you're listening to this on Michigan radio, is that your experience of yourself? You think you don't like to work? People in the state don't like to work?
Right.
That is what Jamie Dimon, who you may be well keeping your deposits with, your hard-earned money maybe stashed with Chase Bank, Jamie Dimon supervising your money, he thinks you don't like to work and that your problem with your boss, your problem with stagnant social mobility, your problem with the jobs going to China in this state is that you don't like to work. Now, to go back to the original point, why is Jamie Dimon saying that? Because he's a mean guy? Maybe. I actually think what's going on there is Jamie Dimon is pretty illiterate about the goings-on of other people's lives. That's, to me, how people talk when they actually don't have a lot of data about most people. That's the kind of thing, like, guys with those business vests with their investment fund on it who, like, hang out together in conferences in Aspen and Davos say to each other in the absence of any kind of real human people in their lives who can tell them contrary information. And so I think the kind of sequestration of the plutocrats from basic data about regular people is a very big part of the problem. And then it becomes a bigger part of the problem when, in addition to being rich, we give them all these opportunities to turn their wealth into influence over public life, money and politics, philanthropy that then reshapes education. Here in Michigan, you know, the DeVos family having enormous influence in education in the western part of the state. Like, who are they? Who are these people? Who are these people? Why does the fact that they happen to get rich mean that they should decide what public education is like? Why do we still call it public education if they get to be in charge of it?
This whole series of conversations in our office launched in part over a constituent asking Kamala Harris months and months ago if it were essentially, is there a moral or ethical argument that billionaires should exist? So should billionaires exist? Is there a moral or ethical argument in favor of billionaires?
We've tried billionaires existing for quite a while now, and we haven't gotten very good results from it. So I am in favor of trying an America in which billionaires don't exist. And I'm open enough to say if, you know, after a generation of trying that, we don't like it, we can go back to having billionaires again. But I think, you know, in all seriousness, we should have a tax code that essentially prevents that kind of accumulation of wealth before the basic needs of most people are met. You know, I think if we got to a place where, you know, every child in this country got a world-class education and nobody was hungry and the, you know, pensions for retirees and older people were secure and education at the higher level was affordable or free, I think if you got to that point and you say, do I have a problem with someone having $1 billion, I would have a lot less of a problem. But right now, let's be very clear. That money, I mean, I live in New York City. I've been to the Hamptons a couple times. I have seen that money. I've, like, it's right there. That money is specifically money that could have been funding a scholarship or a, you know, free tuition from the state at a college here in Michigan and is instead locked in a pool in the Hamptons, right? So there's a big notion to not try to not make money zero-sum, but money in many cases is zero-sum. That money could either have been kept by that family for their fourth house or it could have been paid to the state and gone to any number of programs. And so I think we need to rein in the billionaires. And there's a further reason, in addition to funding things. I think it is plausible to argue that that kind of wealth concentration, just having people that wealthy in a society, is fundamentally incompatible with democracy. If you have $50 billion, it is just too hard to make sure that you do not have influence in the society in excess of your one vote every year or two. It's really hard to do that. It's really hard to limit the political influence of someone like Jeff Bezos, even though in theory we're all committed to one person, one vote. It's a lot easier to just not have those kinds of fortunes developed in the first place and to have that money paid out as wages and taxes while the money is still being made.
Anand Giridharadas is a journalist and the author of Winners Take All, The Elite Charade of Changing the World. Coming up, you might have seen on social media posts that pets around the world are enjoying spending more time with their owners because of the COVID-19 pandemic. We'll check in with the Michigan Humane Society in just a bit. Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Laura Weber Davis, in for April Bear. I've become really interested during this quarantining of America about what we can learn from others who have experienced deep isolation and uncertainty. So try this on for size. A young woman moves alone to the rural wilderness of the Upper Peninsula without the social connection of camera phones. That was the case for a young woman named Lucille, who moved to the UP about 100 years ago to teach school children. What she didn't anticipate was the Spanish flu engulfing her in the isolated landscape along Lake Superior. Her story is documented in a book titled A Far Different Path, written by her grandson, Michael Stone. And Michael joins us now. Michael, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Your grandmother's name was Lucille Ball, which is
That's right.
amazing. Not the comedian.
Not the same one.
So tell us about your grandmother, please.
My grandmother was born before the turn of the century, and she was a small town farm girl. She grew up in Albion, Michigan, and she had never left home until she went up to Munising during the war and during the epidemic. Her entire world had revolved, you know, within a 5 to 10 mile radius of Albion. Which is an interesting place because it was certainly a rural farm community, but Albion College is there as well. Mm-hmm. So she went to college there and had just graduated with her teaching degree.
So she wasn't necessarily afraid of a rural life or being isolated in a country landscape, but the UP is a whole different story. What would Munising have looked like during that period of time?
Well, you know, I went up to Munising to research the book, and so I read the newspapers from the day, and it had only been founded 22 years earlier, which was the same year that Lucille had been born.
Wow.
And it was organized around many, many mills that were producing lumber up there. So I really likened it to it had a feel of a Western frontier town. And it was about a 22-hour train ride from home, which I think was a pretty significant excursion for a young woman who hadn't been very far from home before.
How common was it for young women to set off and go teach school? Obviously, women would have been required to help at home if possible at that time. Was it fairly common for them to set out on their own like that?
My understanding was no, that it wasn't. And my understanding also is that the high school teachers back then were mostly male. And the reason that she even got a call to come up there and teach was that they had been losing the male teachers to the war effort. And so they were having to tap young women to come up and teach at the high school. So I think it was pretty uncommon.
But she also was engaged to a young man who was called to serve in the war. Tell us about him.
Her fiance Howard had just been drafted into the war in April of 1918, and she ventured up to Munising in August. He was overseas by then. He had just arrived in France, and he worked as a, they called it a litter bearer. So he was the guy that ran out into the fields to collect injured soldiers and take them back to the ambulances. But he was already stationed in France by the time she went to Munising.
She's letter writing at this point. She doesn't have social media or a cell phone to keep contact right. with him via FaceTime. Talk a little bit about the letter writing exchanges.
Well, after my grandmother died and we discovered this story, part of what we discovered was that she kept about 40 letters from Howard that he had sent to her while he was overseas. I didn't have access to the letters that she had written, but I had access to these letters that were spaced pretty well during his time in France. So it gave me a really clear picture of what his experiences were while he was over there. He also did end up getting injured, and that's a big part of this story, is at the same time that the flu hit up in Munising, Lucille's letters to Howard were starting to get returned, and they were stamped wounded on them. So she knew that he had been injured, but she had no way of knowing what happened to him for many, many weeks.
Why would the letters, if he were wounded, why would the letters have been returned, assuming he was still alive?
The soldiers got stuck wherever they were wounded. And back then, of course, there was no way to track where they were or, you know, and, but their troop that they were with continued to move on. And they would get stuck with, you know, at a hospital or wherever they were at when they were injured. And so they knew where the troop was that had moved on from there, but they didn't know where he was. So the letters couldn't get to him.
So let's talk about the grip of the Spanish flu. Do you know much about what her experience was with the Spanish flu while she was up there?
You know, I know quite a bit because Munising has done a great job of preserving their newspapers. They had a paper called the Munising News. It came out once a week on Fridays, and it's all stored in the library up there. So I was able to go through it week by week during this time period and see exactly what was going on up there.
And what was her experience? Did she have to change gears, as many people probably did, being a school teacher?
Yes. What was interesting about Munising is the mayor up there decided to close the schools immediately when the governor of Michigan started limiting, you know, the size of groups that could meet. They were reducing how many people could be at church or at stores. And when that warning came out from the governor of Michigan, Munising decided to close their schools immediately. So they then asked the teachers to serve as health clerks, and they paired the women, young women up. And their task was to go around town and visit every home every day to look for illness. And so that's what my grandmother was asked to do at that time.
That must have been scary.
I think it must have been really scary because there was also a period of time where, because they were so isolated, Munising wasn't even on the main railroad line. You had to take a smaller railroad from Munising Junction, which is just outside the city. So they were very isolated. And so they knew that this epidemic was getting really bad in some of the larger cities around them, certainly down in Detroit, but Marquette was getting hit very badly. And so they knew it was coming, but they didn't know when it was going to get there, and they didn't know how bad it would be.
Do you know what Lucille's experience was like as it was hitting Munising?
Yeah, she was, you know, busy functioning as this health clerk, and she had her rounds that she had to do every day. So she was doing that. The women were also working to make gauze masks at that time. There was a very significant Red Cross effort. And then eventually my grandmother volunteered to be a nurse when the epidemic finally did hit in Munising, because there were two reasons. Medical professionals were already overseas with the war, so there wasn't a lot of nurses available. But then the nurses that were there were very scared, and they were having trouble getting people to volunteer.
What do you think that we should take away from either Lucille's story or, in general, the American story during the Spanish flu that we could apply to today?
Well, I think one of the big things is this idea of preparing sooner than later. I went and did some research about the death rates up in that part of Michigan, and municing between 1917 and 1918, their death rate to influenza actually went down as this pandemic was going on. And I attribute that to the fact that they closed the schools very quickly. The mayor was very strict about the restrictions in the town. And, you know, a lot of people were very angry about that, which in all of this played out in the paper. People were ignoring his rules to stay in. People weren't following the restrictions. And he was saying, well, I'm going to make the restrictions worse if people can't follow them. And in the end, you know, of course, they didn't know this as it was happening. But looking back, we see that it worked. There were very few deaths in Munising. So as hard as this, you know, quarantine that we're all living through is, and self-isolation, it really, you know, works.
Do you think about this story a lot as you're sitting home? You started writing this book far before we were in our current situation, so.
Quite a bit. You know, it's really given me a new perspective on what she must have been going through and what some of the feelings she was faced with were like, how scary it was. You know, and back then, as you've referred to, there was much less information. You know, there were no iPhones. There was no way to get information. And so I think it must have been especially terrifying, you know, to not know what was happening.
Right. A few days late anyway, especially with a flu that was moving so quickly.
Yes, absolutely.
So what do you think that we can all learn about coping with uncertainty? And did you learn something yourself while writing this book?
You know, the other part of this was the uncertainty that my grandmother faced with her fiance being injured in the war. And what I think Lucille did, what I think that was partly what was behind her desire to volunteer as a nurse. You know, she couldn't control what was going on around her, but she could try to help others, and she could, you know, have control over what she did to contribute to things getting better. And I've always found that pretty inspiring because, you know, she was up there by herself. She was separated from her family. She didn't know if they were well either. And, you know, under those circumstances, it would have been understandable had she just sort of holed up on her own and, you know, just taken care of herself and gotten through it. But instead, she went in and volunteered when other people wouldn't to care for people who were sick. And I think that's what kind of got her through.
Michael Stone, he's the author of A Far Different Path, a story of his grandmother up in the Upper Peninsula during the Spanish flu. You can find more information about his book at www.afardifferentpath.com. Michael Stone joined us by Skype today. Michael, thank you so much.
Thank you, Laura.
Well, we've talked a lot about how the ongoing spread of COVID-19 and the recent stay-at-home order is affecting us all, and we'll keep talking about it. But these new major life changes that are affecting the economy and how we work also have an impact on the lives of our furry friends. Anna Christman is with the Michigan Humane Society, and she's here to tell us more. Anna, welcome.
Thank you guys so much for having me.
So tell us, what happens to the kennels during these times?
Well, you know, it's been a very interesting situation to put all of us in. So at Michigan Humane Society, when the stay-at-home order first came down, one of the first things, obviously, that we have to be cognizant of, just like everybody else, is our contact with the public, how much our staff are in contact with each other, and honestly, the safety of our animals, making sure that should something happen, that our animals are able to still be well taken care of, receive all their medical care, enrichment, and things like that. So one of the first things we actually did was we suspended intakes and adoptions, other than those intakes that require emergency basis. And we also limited our vet services. So we started there just to kind of be able to assess everything that was going on in the facilities, really get a good handle on where the animals are at, who's in treatment, who can be moved on, that sort of thing. So the first step was actually we now have over 400 animals in foster homes around the metro area, which is phenomenal. Our volunteers stepped up in the hugest way for us. The next step then, once we had moved those animals that could be moved into foster care, we then consolidated the animals that were still in our care, whether because they needed ongoing medical attention or things like that. So all of our animals are actually now currently housed at our Westland facility. So that's been an interesting jump for many of our staff who perhaps have not worked out of that facility before. So they're adjusting to a new way of life in a new building on top of everything else. And then our cruelty and rescue teams are still operational 7 days a week in the area, but those animals are also now being taken to our Westland facility to receive continued care and everything like that.
The Westland facility where I adopted the two dogs I've adopted in my life, and let me just say, produces excellent dogs.
Well, thank you so much for adopting.
So, I want to ask you kind of a strange question. One of the things I've heard, you know, there was a study that came out of China that the virus itself was not communicable through dogs because there was that concern that dogs would bring the virus into the house in their bodies. But then there's this other question now that I've heard some pet owners raise about, well, what if somebody sneezed on my dog or rubbed noses with my dog and then that dog comes and rubs noses with me? Is there any evidence that it can be transmitted on the surface of an animal?
So what the CDC is recommending is obviously that you take the same precautions that you would take normally. So dogs, just like humans, tend to fomite, meaning that we can carry viruses and germs on our clothing, on our shoes, you know, on our purses, on our backpacks, that sort of thing. At this time, to the best of my knowledge, there is no evidence that dogs are carriers in that sense, where such as, again, if you sneezed on your dog and then somebody else pet your dog, that sort of thing. But we are recommending folks follow CDC guidelines. So if you're handling your pets, make sure you're washing your hands. I am very guilty of forgetting. You know, I'll spend 20 minutes of cuddle time with the dogs in between conference calls and things like that. And sometimes I forget to wash my hands. And the CDC is reminding folks that that's a great thing to be doing to limit any potential spread of really any disease. The other thing, too, is they are recommending don't let your pets lick your face. Don't let your pets, you know, lick any part of you that potentially has the ability to transmit any sort of viruses. And the thing is it's not just COVID-19. It would also be, you know, there are parasites our pets can pick up that humans are susceptible to. So we're following those CDC guidelines, and they're guidelines that pretty much everybody should be following regardless of the scenario that we're in.
Mm-hmm. So let's get back to adoptions and fostering. There's a lot of boredom going on right now at homes. Have you seen an increase in applications or desire to adopt or foster?
Oh, yes, absolutely. So we, like I mentioned before, we do have suspended adoptions right now. We're working on what's going to be the safest and least contact way for folks to adopt pets from Michigan Humane while making sure that we are following the guidelines that Governor Whitmer has set forth in terms of essential services and that sort of thing. As far as fostering goes, we, like I mentioned before, we've put over 400 animals into foster in the last couple weeks, which I don't even know what number I could compare that to because it is so far above and beyond where we would normally be. And we are definitely still accepting new foster applications. So just because we're doing limited services doesn't necessarily mean that animals have stopped coming into the shelters. We are still offering emergency intakes. Our cruelty and rescue teams, again, are still operating. So there are definitely still animals in need of assistance. So if folks are interested, we are more than happy to take their foster application and see if we've got a pet that will fit for them and the lifestyle.
I want to look a little bit farther out. During periods of recession and economic depression, animals, whether it's pets or livestock, are sometimes the first group that can suffer neglect as people lose wealth or the means to care for them. Do you expect, or have there been conversations about what happens heading into this period of uncertainty for animals and for your organization?
So I think we always have that conversation in the back of our mind, right? A lot of us were in the workforce at the time of the 08-09 recession. And so we kind of remember what went on during that time frame. We are very, very proud to be able to offer a lot of community support programs, though, for folks that may find themselves in need of some additional assistance. So we offer a pet pantry program, which helps make sure that folks stay supplied with food and other essential supplies. We also do offer a Protect a Pet series that will make sure that animals are staying vaccinated. We can provide rabies vaccines as well as general health vaccines, microchips, and things of that sort. And then we also do offer other assistance programs throughout the course of the year, kind of on a case-by-case basis for medical care and other forms of assistance.
Anna Chrisman, joining us from your backyard?
Yeah, actually.
It sounds lovely.
You know, I'm taking advantage of the fact that the weather's kind of decent. I'm not going to lie.
The birds are adding a lovely element to this conversation. So Anna Chrisman with the Michigan Humane Society, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks, you guys, very much.
Have you been spending a lot of time playing or lounging with your dog? Has your cat been participating in your Zoom meetings? Or you've been attempting to work from home with a feline pawing at your keyboard? We want to see your pics. Send them to stateside@michiganradio.org. We'll be featuring those pictures on our website because the world could use more cute animal content right now. That's our show for today. We'll see you tomorrow.